Increasingly, Christians in the West are finding themselves living in a mission field. How did we get here?
Well, expressive individualism is the idea that I am most myself, or I am most, we would say, authentic, when I am able to express outwardly that which I feel inwardly. The most dramatic example I could give at this point in time would be the transgender question. You know, 100 years ago, if somebody had gone to their doctor and said, "I'm a woman trapped in a man's body," the doctor would have responded and said, "You know, that's a problem with your mind. It's a problem with your inner feelings. We need to treat your inner feelings and bring them into conformity with your body." Today, if you go to your doctor and say, "I'm a woman trapped in your man's body," your doctor will probably respond, "That's a problem with your body."
We'll dive into all of that today and more with Dr. Carl Truman. But first, a word from ABWE President Paul Davis.
ABWE missionaries are coming beside the lost and the hurting around the world. And through the Global Gospel Fund, they're pulling people from the darkness and training them as leaders. They're planting churches, and they're even beginning their own missions movements. You may already support one ABWE missionary. Would you consider a gift to the Global Gospel Fund to support all 1,000 of our missionaries? Thank you for that.
Become a partner today at abwe.org/globalgospelfund. Welcome to the Missions Podcast, the show that explores your hard questions on missions, theology, and practice to help goers think and thinkers go. I'm Alex Kochman, Director of Advancement and Communications with ABWE, joined again by Scott Dunford, West Coast Advancement Coordinator and Lead Church Planter for Redeemer Church in Fremont, California. I am really excited to get into our next interview here today, Scott. I just finished reading Dr. Truman's book a few weeks ago. Actually, it was last week. Came highly recommended to me by a friend, a mutual friend. And I think it has incredible import for goers and senders here, too, because this is one of those topics. It's going to sound like we're just talking about America and the West, but I think that this has massive implications for missions as well.
Absolutely. So we're excited to just dive in with this. So I want to introduce our listeners, those of you who don't know Dr. Truman. Carl Truman is a Christian theologian and ecclesiastical historian. He was professor of historical theology and church history at Westminster Theological Seminary. And then in 2018, he resigned his position at Westminster to become a full-time undergraduate professor at Grove City College. There in Pennsylvania. Woo. And also, he's an author of many books. I don't need to go into all of them. He contributes to First Things and Reformation 21 and co-hosts the Mortification of Spin podcast. But the book we're going to talk about today and apply it to, I think, our little niche of missions is a fantastic book, which I highly recommend, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. And so, Dr. Truman, welcome to our show. We're so glad to have you.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me on.
The question that's on my mind, especially as you know, we hear a lot of people on the Twitter sphere and everything else discussing sociology and philosophy. And here you are, a theologian. You've studied church history. You've written extensively about it. And yet you write a book really delving into some of these huge sociological topics that dealing with our current age. Why would someone like you dive into that, first of all? But secondly, you know, going into this, why did that lead you to write this book?
Well, first of all, I think of myself more as a historian than a theologian. And one of the great things about being a historian is history is a multidisciplinary exercise. There is no single form of history. If you're writing history, you're inevitably engaging with sociology, with philosophy, with a whole range of disciplines. So as a historian, you develop an interesting skill set. And I've always been of the opinion that if you can use those skills in one period of history, you should be able to use them in another period of history. So when a few years ago, Crossway approached me about writing this book, one of the things that attracted me to the project was, first of all, it was not something I'd written on before. I'm a 16th, 17th century historian. And after 25 years of doing that, I probably made my contribution and was getting rather bored with it. This was a completely different thing. Secondly, it takes me to the heart of an issue that I think is of pressing significance for, I think, people in general and Christians in particular. And that's, how has the way we understand ourselves to be come to be so dramatically transformed in recent years? Most obviously in the realm of sexual morality and sexual identity, but those things rest upon deeper and more longstanding changes. How did those changes come about? And that, I think, is a question that appeals both to my historical curiosity. I always want to know why something has happened the way it does. But also, I think it has distinct practical and pastoral implications for Christians, because understanding how people think about themselves allows us to do that which Paul does so well in the book of Acts, and that is bring the gospel to bear on people in a way that challenges them and touches them at exactly the point they need to be challenged or touched.
Well, when you talk about our culture, you know, central to all of that is this idea of the self. The title of your book really encapsulates it, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. We are self-obsessed, and that sounds like a very simple, flat, you know, dismissal of our culture, but it's evolved that way over time. So would you explain to us, what is expressive individualism, and how is it different, in your opinion, from the way that previous generations understood themselves?
Well, expressive individualism is the idea that I am most myself, or I am most, we would say, authentic, when I am able to express outwardly that which I feel inwardly. Now, a lot of people might say, well, isn't that how it's always been? There's always been this consciousness of what we might call an inner space. You look at the Psalms, for example. The psalmist clearly has a psychology, clearly has inner feelings. And I would say, absolutely, human beings, we're made with that inner space. Difference in the modern world, the difference in expressive individualism is this: it's the authority we give to that inner space. In times past, it may be that, yes, you had these feelings, but you realized that the issue was you needed to bring them into conformity to the outside world. Whereas now we tend to authorize those feelings in a way that says, no, the outside world must be brought to acknowledge and accept those feelings. The most dramatic example I could give at this point in time would be the transgender question. You know, 100 years ago, if somebody had gone to their doctor and said, I'm a woman trapped in a man's body, the doctor would have responded and said, you know, that's a problem with your mind. It's a problem with your inner feelings. We need to treat your inner feelings and bring them into conformity with your body. Today, if you go to your doctor and say, I'm a woman trapped in your man's body, your doctor will probably respond, that's a problem with your body. We need to bring the external reality into conformity with your inner feelings and desires. Now, that's an extreme example, but it rests upon a culture where, by and large, we tend to give great authority to our inner feelings and see our fulfillment and our satisfaction as involving the outward expression of those feelings and the recognition of those feelings by others in society.
So applying this, you know, to the area of missions, missionaries, obviously, if they're going to be an effective missionary, have to study other cultures and have to understand, you know, what's going on in the culture. And as you go through this and talk about, you know, kind of the rise of expressive individualism and how this need to show authenticity by living out our true inner self, you know, comes to bear, you certainly, you know, shine a lot of light on some of the things that are going on currently in our culture. But you also bring up this idea of the difference between culture and anti-culture, and you kind of talk about some of the developments of culture. So as you outline some of those differences, can you explain for us what is a culture versus an anti-culture, and how have we gotten to this place where we are really living in what you describe as an anti-culture?
Sure. The specific contrast of culture and anti-culture is something I borrow from the writings of Philip Reeve, who's one of the thinkers that I interact with most in the book. Reeve was a secular Jewish thinker, professor of sociology at the University of Pennsylvania for many years, but very insightful in his understanding of the world. He was the guy who in 1966 wrote a very influential book, The Triumph of the Therapeutic, which really anticipates a lot of the pathologies, the characteristics of the age in which we live. Now, when he talks about culture and anti-culture, it's important that we understand that he's using the term culture in a very specific way. I mean, listeners may be listening and saying, yeah, but everybody has a culture. How can we possibly talk about anti-culture? And typically, I think when missionaries, let's say, talk about a culture, they generally mean the kind of the context in which a missions is to take place.
Right.
The culture is the set of values, the set of beliefs, the set of communal practices that a particular location or a particular group of people sanctions in order to be a coherent social unit. So, you know, India has a distinct culture, England has a distinct culture, North America America has distinct culture, even distinct cultures, depending where you are. Reeve is using the term culture in a much more narrow and technical sense. When he talks about culture, he means the systems in place for the transmitting of values from one generation to the next. That by and large, culture is all about communicating the values of the present to the next generation. And that involves institutions like the church or like government or like the Boy Scouts. There are all these social institutions that communicate values. Don't simply pass them down unchanged. Often these institutions will modify them a bit, but they're basically there to establish a kind of continuity of values and practice from one generation to the next. Reeve says that modern culture, in the broad sense of, you know, the set of values that we live with, modern culture is interesting because for the first time in history, we have a culture that is committed not to the transmitting of the values of the past, but to the overthrowing or the contradicting of the values of the past. And that's what Reeve calls an anti-culture. So in that broad sense of the word, sure, we live in a culture. Everybody lives in a culture. We all live in a context where there's a set of social practices, values, et cetera, that permeate the atmosphere, that make life comprehensible to us. But the difference between our culture today and, say, the culture of America 100 years ago is that our culture today is specifically intentional in its overthrowing of the values of the past. The sexual revolution would be a good example. The sexual revolution is not about the modification of the sexual practices and values and beliefs of earlier generations. It's about the repudiation of those values, the rejection of those values. And that's what makes today an anti-culture.
As I read the book, and Scott, I don't know if you had this experience, yeah, it was eye-opening in so many ways, and it's all Rousseau's fault. That's really the biggest takeaway. But but there was times in reading the book, I felt as though I was reading an autopsy on a culture that died in a head-on collision with a locomotive. And what I mean by that is, well, was it this piece of shrapnel to his heart that killed him? Was it the piece of shrapnel to his brain? Right, and you're kind of going through it. And there was times in reading it, I almost, and this is not a critique at all, I felt as though, well goodness, and I wanted to throw up my hands and say it's all connected. Obviously, all of these things sort of led to the demise of the culture that we're in. But you do unpack it in a very systematic way. So what you have first is the psychologizing of our notion of the self. Then through Nietzsche and others, you have the sexualizing of the psyche. And then finally, where we're at now with the current LGBTQ plus movement or movements is the politicization of sexuality. So all of it comes together. It's not overnight that we got here. But I'm interested also in how it's affected the Christian church. How has expressive individualism and the current anti-culture, as Reeve calls it, affected the Christian church in the West?
That's a huge question, and there are a number of aspects to that. But I want to preface my answer to this by saying the first thing is I don't want to come across as saying that expressive individualism is all bad. You know, there is a sense that we have an inner life. There is a sense in which it's appropriate that that inner life finds some kind of outward expression. And one of the interesting things about Rousseau, of course, is that at the same time as Rousseau is emphasizing the importance of inner sentiments or emotions, you have Jonathan Edwards, you have the Wesleys, you have George Whitefield doing the same kind of thing in Christianity. And one of the things that expressive individualism does by emphasizing the individual is it highlights the importance of emotions, and it highlights the importance of the individual's stand relative to the world around. So in the evangelical revivals, which are a little bit like the Christian version of Rousseau, we see an important emphasis upon emotion. We see an important emphasis upon the urgency of the Christian faith, the need for the individual to close for themselves with Christ in a way that would not have been the case, even in the Reformation, and certainly not in the Middle Ages. So all of that is to preface to say that the idea of the expressive individual actually has had some good impact on the church. Right. When you think of the great hymns of the Wesleys, when you think of the theology of Jonathan Edwards, there are good elements in these things that are important.
Augustine, right? All the way, the original individualist.
Well, could go back to Augustine and say you find it there. What you get in the 18th century is it's being brought out and accented more, I think. But yeah, absolutely. Where I think it's proved to be problematic, there's a number of fronts. One, it's led to a lot of sentimental praise songs that focus on us and our feelings. Now, the Wesleys wrote some rubbish. The great thing about having written 200 years ago is that time is a great corroder of garbage. We probably have 20, 25 Wesley hymns in our hymn books now, and they're great hymns. They wrote a lot more than 20 or 25 hymns. They wrote a lot of junk, and that junk has been eroded over time. That's why I always feel that people are very hard on contemporary hymn writers. If you write two or three good hymns in a lifetime, that's not a bad result for being a hymn, but for a hymn writer. You can write a lot of rubbish and still contribute two or three really good things to the hymn book of the church. I think it's led to a lot of emphasis upon Christianity as a kind of therapy. You go to church to be made to feel good. And again, that connects to another aspect of the modern world, which is it is good, but also has a bad side. Freedom of religion. Freedom of religion is a great thing. Who wants to live in an era where there's no freedom of religion? But where you have a country with freedom of religion, you have a wide variety of churches. And where you have a wide variety of churches, religion becomes a choice. And the church becomes a competitor in the consumer marketplace. So you will tend to get churches that cater to what people want. And in an expressive individualist world, people want to be made happy. If you come to my church and I tell you, this is why you're miserable, or you could go to the guy next door who says to you, this is how you can be healthy, wealthy, and happy, who's going to win? So I think expressive individualism parlaying into religious freedom has led to a downward pressure on the biblical truth content of the gospel. So in those numerous ways, one could see it affecting. And I think on the individual Christian's attitude to the church, we tend not to think of the church now as an authoritative body to tell us about reality. We tend to think of it as something we buy into to the extent that it's helpful for us to live.
Well, there's a lot here, and I'm already seeing the connections with missions. Those are the same things we struggle with here, too, is understanding the role of the local church, right? These things that aren't purely individual. But we need to get all of that with Dr. Truman here in just a moment.
Have you ever been approached by a student expressing a missionary call? For the last 15 years, Spurgeon College's Fusion program has been equipping students for missions through life-on-life discipleship, college coursework, and intensely practical training. If you know a student desiring to become a missionary, send them to Fusion at Spurgeon College as their next step. To learn more about how we are equipping students for a lifetime, visit spurgeoncollege.com/fusion.
Hi, I'm Scott Dunford, and I'd like to share with you about a new nonprofit ministry established to help churches, Christian schools, and other ministries protect children and prevent abuse. Rich Hamar from Church Law and Tax states that the number one reason that drives churches to court is child sexual abuse. I can't think of anything more devastating to these lives, their families, and our witness before a watching world than sexual abuse that takes place in ministry. The traumatic impact often leaves the vulnerable not wanting anything to do with God or His people. Our efforts toward evangelism, discipleship, and spiritual formation are not only neutralized, but shattered. Evangelical Council for Abuse Prevention was formed to help ministry leaders understand the complexities of child protection and abuse prevention. They are establishing standards and an accreditation program that will help verify that appropriate measures measures are in place at your church or ministry. Learn more about them. Find a helpful and free assessment tool to help you see how you measure up in this area. Go to abuseprevention.org and click on the link for this resource assessment. Evangelical Council for Abuse Prevention.
And this June, attend the national conference. Go to abuseprevention.org and register with ABWE21 as the promo code to receive 20% off your ticket. That's promo code ABWE21 to receive 20% off.
Brooks Bucer, president of Radius International.
I am here with Mark Dever, senior pastor at Capitol Hill Baptist and president of Nine Marks.
When you go to a culture that's a different language than yours, you're ending up in a kind of majority language that's been reached. And there are other peoples still more hidden, and it's those people who are often almost entirely unreached, and they take more cross-cultural effort. Is there a way we can better train people to have more realistic expectations of what life is like in the kind of two steps away from my culture, and be able to sustain family life with its normal difficulties there, so that there can be a long years and even decades long witness in that culture? And it seems like Radius is set up to provide that training. Radius is about reaching unreached people groups.
Go to radiusinternational.org, radiusinternational.org.
Well, we're back with Dr. Carl Truman, author of The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. We're talking about how we got to where we're at now in Western civilization, and also how that's affecting the church and missions, as we increasingly, even senders here in the U.S., are finding ourselves living on a mission field. So, Dr. Truman, what are the differences in the way an 18th century believer and a modern day believer might consider their calling to missions, if we can call it that? So taking that as a case study, how would they have approached it in the past versus how we approach it now? Do you see any temptation of ministry becoming, you know, sort of this this self-expressive kind of performance for us today?
That's an interesting question, because on the whole, just talking about life in general and calling slash jobs in general, I would say part of the temptation today, or part of the pressure, is to think of our jobs as something that provide us with an inner sense of psychological satisfaction. In the book, I contrast myself with my grandfather. For my grandfather, if you'd asked him if he got job satisfaction, if he'd even understood the question, if it was even an issue for him, he'd probably have said something like, yeah, I get job satisfaction. I'm able to earn enough money to put shoes on my children's feet, food on the table. My grandfather worked in a factory all his life. It was hard, repetitive work of a kind that I would have found very unsatisfying. Satisfied him because it allowed him to provide for others. Me, I get a real kick out of teaching. My job satisfaction really comes from what it does for me psychologically on the whole. And I'm guessing that that could be a temptation, perhaps, in Christian circles, that one might feel, well, you know, I need to become a minister, or I need to become a missionary, because I think that that would give me a tremendous buzz to be standing up in front of people proclaiming the gospel week after week or something like that. Where I think that that's possibly less of a temptation for that kind of work than other work is that, by and large, there's not a lot of money involved in ministry or being a missionary.
This is true.
There are easier ways of finding psychological satisfaction. So I would say it's possible that could be a temptation. How widespread a temptation that might be, it's hard to tell.
Yeah, we were talking before we came on the air. Scott, you and I have both had conversations as mobilizers of missionaries, of people who do say, well, I really want to travel the world, or I feel like I need to do this for me to make my life count, because I don't want to make my life, I don't want to waste my life, right? Which is valid, and there's much good in that, right? There's a lot of godly piety in that.
Yeah.
But the problem is, who is the subject of all of those sentences? It's me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, God can certainly use instincts like that. And the purest missionary in all the world is going to have something of that in their motivation. But yeah, as you say, certainly if that was the overriding motivation, it is interesting that it is rather inwardly me-directed rather than outwardly directed.
And I wonder, you know, how much this, I mean, clearly we see that when culture and society isn't lined up with God's order, that there's going to be chaos, even internal chaos, psychological chaos. And I wonder how much our young people are really struggling with this idea of like, hey, everyone's finding out their true and authentic self and living it out on Instagram. Why don't I know that? You know, and I counsel young men, even in my own congregation here, you know, who are, you know, getting up to close to 30 years old and really feeling this pressure about what mom and dad expect me to do, which is usually, you know, go into medicine or the tech world. I mean, I'm in the Silicon Valley, you know, everyone's successful here. You know, do something like that versus, you know, what they're finding in their like the faith community they grew up in, which sometimes is very much, you know, about ministry driven and focused on that. And then feeling this inner turmoil of like, what do I do? What is my true best self? And I wonder even, you know, you've written a lot on John Owen. I mean, certainly we've thought a lot about some of the missionaries of old, you know, like William Carey. And I just wonder how different their inner musings about some of these questions would look from the way young people today are trying to think through that. What would you counsel? I mean, counsel a young person who is maybe sensing God's calling into ministry, you know, however we want to define that, really wrestling with going overseas as a missionary, but really wondering, you know, is this the true me? Am I doing the one thing I was created and made to do? Is that a question that even would have come to the mind of like a John Owen?
I think it would have done, but probably in a slightly different form. And I go back to what I said earlier about the authority we give inner feelings now. Mm. Certainly one would want to say that somebody who feels no inward call is probably not called, if I could put it that way. But I do think that what we see in times past is not just the authority of the inner call, but the authority of the external call as well. Mm. And I would say to a young person who's wrestling with, should I go overseas? Should I be training for the ministry? That decision is something that you would be well advised to talk to your pastor, talk to your elders, talk to Christian friends about. Don't just go on your own inner instincts, but take a wide variety of advice from people you trust and people who love you and have a concern for you, and base your ultimate decision on them. And, you know, I'm a Presbyterian. Ultimately, no individual calls themselves to the ministry. Mm. No individual calls themselves to the mission field. If you're a Presbyterian, you have to be called there by the church, and that's our way of institutionalizing that notion of the external call. And I think that that needs to be taken into account as well.
Mm. We're Baptists, and we would agree with that.
Praise God. I mean, I taught at seminary, and there were people I would teach, and they were absolutely convinced they were called to the ministry, but they were incapable of standing in a pulpit and stringing a decent English sentence together.
Yeah.
And I have to say, however much your heart is telling you you're a preacher, if you can't string a decent English sentence together in front of a group of people, you are not called to the ministry, at least at not that point in your life anyway.
I think we could even take that one step further, Scott. I mean, what do you think of this? It doesn't matter how much you have a love for life in a foreign culture, right? Or, you know, I really enjoyed my trip to Uganda, right? And so I'm going to go and live there. If you cannot verbally present the gospel to somebody, that's not a calling to gospel ministry. That's not a missionary calling. That's wanderlust, right? That it's a similar application.
I mean, I would certainly agree with that. And I kept finding myself reading this book, you know, seeing even our Christian missionary endeavors reflected in the sense of, you know, missions as being a way that I find self-fulfillment, which seems to be, you know, really problematic and detrimental because, you know, the same feelings that take you to the field will be the same feelings that bring you back. And if you read through the old biographies of the old missionaries, I mean, you know, Hudson Taylor and Adoniram Judson and William Carey and John Patton and all these, you know, all these men we really respect and admire, Elizabeth Elliot, you know, like they went through very difficult times, and what's, you know, they wanted to quit. They felt like quitting. Their feelings didn't match up with what they were doing. And I'm afraid that, you know, our modern society is, hey, if I don't feel it, then I'm not being true to myself. I need to do exactly what I feel. So that kind of gets me to another question for you, Dr. Truman. as I was reading this book, it hit me, and it's hit me before, but it hit me in a fresh way. The fact that so many of these things are, it's like the water we're swimming in or the air we're breathing. It's hard to even understand, oh, that's how I've thought, that's how my thoughts have drifted, or this is very reflective of the way I think. So how does a Christian go about the process of analyzing their own heart when it comes to these issues? How do you advise someone, or even how do you counsel yourself as you're trying to untangle, you know, the culture or the anti-culture, the way that expressive individualism has affected you? How do you start untangling that and bringing your life more in line with a biblical understanding of who you are as a person?
Sure, it's a good question. I think the first thing to do is to remember that we live in a technical age where we're always looking for techniques to solve the problem for us. This is not something that can be solved in an ultimate way by a technique. I would say that it's a supernatural issue. It's a problem of the human heart, and therefore the foundation to any solution has to be regular attendance on the means of grace, being present in church, hearing the word read, proclaimed, being led in prayer, singing God's praises. There is no substitution for the ordinary church-based Christian life as a foundation. And I think if you are, you know, if you're into that discipline of corporate worship, then you can expect over time that your intuitions will become more and more attuned to the way they should be. Having said that, I do think that there are things we can do that help this process. And one of them is being aware of the water we swim in. There's a sense in which as soon as you've sort of been saying, I was reading your book and, wow, I suddenly realized this or I suddenly realized that. Once the air you breathe or the water you swim in has been pointed out to you, you can never look at it in the same way again. It doesn't solve the problem, but you know, being aware of the problem is itself part of the solution. So I would say, I'm not going to say, you know, the first thing you should do is buy my book and read it. That would be very self-serving.
We'll say that because we agree.
You can say that without it being, but I would say become more self-aware about how the context in which you find yourself shapes the way you think. Are you ever going to have a perfect handle on that? Well, no, you're never going to be able to completely separate yourself from the water and look down on it from nowhere. You're always going to be part of a culture somewhere. But you can become more and more aware of the specific pathologies of that culture. And in fact, missionaries of all people should be able to do this. But what, you know, I'm an immigrant in the United States, and one of the things that I found most helpful about immigrating is it makes you much more aware about the cultural arbitrary nature of the culture you came from, or the contingent nature of the culture you came from. And it means you can spot contingent things in the culture you've come to because you're able to compare the two. Missionaries moving from North America to Uganda should be able to understand North American culture and Ugandan culture better than somebody who's only ever lived in the one place. So missionaries actually have a perfect practical opportunity to realize, yeah, that was the water I was swimming in, and this is the water these people are swimming in.
We do need to understand that as much as expressive individualism has affected us as a church, and we need to kind of hold the mirror up, we also do recognize, yeah, we are swimming in this ocean of it, and we are no longer surrounded by Western Christendom, right? We are pilgrims and sojourners, and that's becoming increasingly more clear. Now, I'm someone who's optimistic about the direction of history. I think the Great Commission will be fulfilled, but it's no mistake that your book is titled something that has to do with the triumph of the modern self, because truly this notion of self has triumphed. What I appreciated most in the book, it was the conclusion, though, that you did give not exactly practical things to do, but things to do, things to be aware of, sort of a roadmap for the future, not offering all of the answers, but recognizing that that we do need something practical to take away if we're going to survive in a context where we are being missionaries here at home. And anyone who's a missionary serving in Western context, we have many missionaries in Europe that listen in, is going to contend with these things. And some of the things that you outline here, and I'd love to hear a little bit more about this. First, you encourage us to understand the role of aesthetics And specifically in the context of the culture war, you know, with abortion, okay, the aesthetics of that are awful, right? It doesn't take a lot of moral reasoning to see imagery of aborted babies, fetuses, and to use that in a way that, you know, it's repugnant. It turns someone away from the idea of abortion. We're not necessarily, though, able to utilize that same sort of aesthetic argument against the modern sexual revolution, because the image of love and love is love and monogamy and look at how beautiful this is, right? That's something where the church is losing ground. And so we need to understand that people are approaching these cultural issues not so much rationally, but aesthetically, and they're intuiting a lot of these things, and it's bypassing all of their immediate reasoning. So first you encourage us to understand the role of aesthetics and imagery and emotion in decision making. Second, you point out that the church has to be a community, and you talked about that just a moment ago. Third, you believe that we need to recover natural law and the importance of the physical body, right? And this is something that evangelicals haven't always done a good job of understanding, but God's goodness in the created order, in male and female, right, in the body, that the body does determine reality and identity. And we as a Christian church need to be rooted in that understanding before we can bring that out into the world. And then finally, you basically say, hey, we have to see ourselves as living in the second century of the church. So not quite the first century, but this is like the second century. We haven't Christianized the Roman Empire yet, right? We really are living in the middle of not always overt persecution, but we are living in a pagan empire. And what does life look like there? We may get to the point in a few hundred years where Christianity is back on the ascendance in the West, but we're not there yet. So the question, with all of that in mind, some practical next steps that people can take: what is the role of a missionary or a pastor or even just everyday Christian in this current cultural climate? How can we be salt and light here and now?
Yeah, it's a difficult question. I'm very influenced by book 19 of Augustine's City of God, St. Augustine wrestling with the sack of Rome in 410 and the flood of Roman refugees across the Mediterranean to where he was ministering in North Africa, and panicking. They were panicking because Rome, the eternal city, had fallen to the Visigoths. And there was a big question about, you know, has the Christian God abandoned us? Should we go back to the pagan gods? And raised all kinds of challenges for how Christians should live in that society. And Augustine's model for the church in the current age is this. He sees that history is all about the earthly city and the city of God. And Christians are in this interesting situation where we are really citizens of both, or we belong in some sense to both. And Augustine stressed the importance of Christians being good citizens of the earthly city to the extent that they could. And the way he articulated it was, there are many loves, there are many things that pagans, that the citizens of the earthly city, or only citizens of the earthly city, if you like, share with Christians. We want peace. We want situations where, you know, we might say the economy is good. We want a situation where the innocent are protected, where wickedness is put down. There are a whole lot of things that we can love and share in common with our pagan neighbors. And I think one of the things that Christians need to do is think very much in terms of, we need to be good citizens of this earthly city. That's not to say that this earthly city is the ultimate thing, but there are many things that we can look to that we share as loves with our pagan neighbors. And it's okay for us to be co-belligerent on those fronts with them and to work towards them. It's okay. In fact, it's important that Christians are good employees to the extent they can, et cetera, et cetera. Christians should be the best employee any pagan employs. On the other hand, there are heavenly loves. The ultimate love of the believer has to lie in the world beyond. It has to lie in the heavenly city. And there, I think that raises questions then as to where our loyalty to one and where our loyalty ends and our loyalty to the other, you know, has to trump loyalty to the earthly city. And that's where it's going to be difficult for us as Christians, because there are things coming down the pike, even this week with the Biden administration signing into law certain transgender rights. There are going to be things that really pinch us in this earthly city where we are not able to go along with the actions, the policies of the rulers of this earthly city. And that's where we'll have to take our stand. But I would say being salt and light means being a good citizen to the extent you can of this earthly city and making a stand on the gospel at those points where the interests of the earthly city and the interests of the city of God diverge. I also think, as and you alluded to this in the list of things that you said I pointed to in that last chapter, I think the church being a community is very important. All human beings, we have two basic desires, I think, built into us. We want to be free. We intuitively think of ourselves as free, intentional agents. On the other hand, we also want to belong. We want to be valued by others. And it's not easy to tie those two things together. And I think much of the problem in modern society comes from our inability to tie those two together. We either list towards freedom or we list towards conformity and belonging. The church should be the place where the two of those things come together in a harmony, where there's no tension between them. Jesus talks about us being in the Son, and if the Son sets you free, you should be free indeed. We become free by belonging to Christ. Freedom and belonging are one and the same thing. And the church is to anticipate that in being a loving community that serves its members and serves those outside. So that may look different in different contexts, in different cultures, but I think an emphasis upon community. The gospel is a proclamation of what God has done, but the gospel gains plausibility, humanly speaking, when it is spoken by a community that lives as a true community.
I think we see that even being played out here in a part of the country that I think is much farther down the road than even Pennsylvania, where both of you guys are, in that people are longing for community and they find it in the church, and the church is providing it in a way that there's nowhere else to go for it. And I think that's kind of the way Christ designed it to be, that we would be a place that really people can experience a relationship with Christ and relationship through his people, the body. So thank you so much, Dr. Truman. It was really an honor to have you on the show. I want to encourage our listeners, go out, get The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, Cultural Amnesia, Expressive Individualism, and the Road to Sexual Revolution by Carl Truman from Crossway. Excellent book. Take your time reading it. You'll want to digest it. But how else can people find out about you and the other things you're writing? And maybe even you had shared with me a little bit of more of some of the other things you're working on regarding some of these topics. Would you mind sharing some of that with our listeners too?
Not at all. It's a pleasure. I'm actually writing a short book, not a summary of the big book, but covering much the same kind of ideas. A short book that will hopefully be useful for, it'll be a quicker read for pastors, for lay people, and will also come with study questions, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm hoping that we can get this material into the hands of, I don't want to sound patronizing, but into the hands of ordinary Christians who don't have the time and the privilege to sit around and read a 400-page book. So I'm working on that at the moment. I do much of my writing these days at First Things, firstthings.com online, which is a religious/conservative website, and also at Public Discourse. And I would recommend that all Christians check the Public Discourse website and the First Things website regularly. Not all of the articles there are Christian, but all of them are of interest to Christians and will help you to think, I think, in very helpful ways about the cultural moment at which we find ourselves.
Well, thank you, Dr. Truman, for joining us today. We do recommend you pick up a copy of his book, and we also recommend that before you go, go ahead and smash that subscribe button if you're not already a regular subscriber to the show. And why don't you share this show with someone else that you think will benefit from this? It'll certainly help us get God's word where it needs to go, and it'll get this content in front of more mission-minded people. To get more content, you can go to apwe.org/podcast or missionspodcast.com. And also, don't forget, if you have any questions or topic suggestions, email alex@missionspodcast.com. Until next week, thank you for listening to the Missions Podcast.